Hi friends, my name is Kevin, and this is the Via Media Podcast. In some expressions of religious thought, there exists some significant confusion around the concepts of truth and love. This struggle persists due to the apparent conflict between the two. Sometimes the truth doesn't feel very loving, and at other times, the demand to love someone comes at the expense of the truth. And for some segments of Christianity, prioritizing truth over love is a banner identifier for someone who is a, quote, true believer. The problem is that this kind of posture is antithetical to the teachings of Jesus and the diverse wisdom found in the biblical tradition. The vision, the way forward for a life lived in fidelity to the truth of Christianity, is one that recognizes love as the truth. And this kind of perspective is a radical paradigm shift that prioritizes the relationship we have with others and how we live as a measure of what truths we actually believe. If more can embrace this way, the truth and love that we are all pursuing could be radically revolutionized. Jared Bias holds an MA in Religion and Biblical Studies and a THM in Old Testament, both from Westminster Theological Seminary. He's an adjunct faculty member of Eastern University, the co-host of the Bible for Normal People podcast, and author of Love Matters More: How Fighting to Be Right Keeps Us from Loving Like Jesus, the topic of tonight's event. Here is my conversation with Jared Bias. Hey, good evening, everybody. This is this guy. Oh, nope. This guy right here, Jared Bias, is here. Thank you so much for joining us. My name's Kevin with Via Media. And before we get started, I want to thank our co-sponsor, Spark Church. And I know that there's a watch party over there. So hello to all of my friends over at our partner church. Thanks so much for joining us and being here. My guest tonight, Jared Bias, has an MA in Religion, Biblical Studies, THM, Old Testament, Westminster Theological Seminary. That's the boring stuff. The really important stuff is that he's the co-host of the very famed, well-known Bible for Normal People podcast, and the author of this amazing book, Love Matters More: How Fighting to Be Right Keeps Us from Loving Jesus. Jared, we are absolutely thrilled that you accepted our invitation. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Absolutely.
So nice to meet you. I'd like to do something a little bit Krista Tippett-ish, if you don't mind. Would you mind starting? We've just met, like, quite literally 60 seconds ago. Would you mind sharing a little bit of your spiritual background and upbringing before we get to the content of your book? And then I've got a host of questions for you, and we'll try to move the needle in the universe, shall we?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in a small town in Texas as a very eager, sincere, and enthusiastic evangelical, both Southern Baptist, more from my dad's side, and charismatic on my mom's side. So speaking in tongues and, gifts of the Spirit, and a lot of integration of our emotions and our feelings and our worship, very music heavy, but then also Southern Baptist, pretty straight-laced. Eventually then went to a Presbyterian church when I was in high school by myself, just because it seemed to fit kind of who I was a little bit more, but still very eager. Always, from the time I was 15 years old, wanted to go to Westminster Seminary and get a PhD in presuppositional apologetics, which is a fancy way of saying arguing people into the faith.
Yes.
That's what I was good at. You know, much to the chagrin of my parents, I was good at arguing. And so that's, you know, if I can argue for Jesus, what better marriage to have than to get to argue, but to do it for Jesus. Mm. So I did end up going to Westminster, but in my time there, really kind of fell in love with the Bible all over again. Mm. As I looked in the nooks and crannies and the original languages and the nuances of our scriptures. Mm. And then ended up being a pastor for a number of years and then a professor, and then started the podcast.
Hmm. I love it. We have a lot of things in common. I started off with apologetics, started reading. Walter Martin was my big go-to person. And then, of course, the Bible Answer Man and Christian Research Institute and all that stuff, taught at college and all that stuff. So I have felt a kinship with you from a distance, even though we've just met. And when I read this book and when actually one of my congregants at Spark pointed it out, I felt as if you and us had been living in parallel universes for the last decade or so. So it was incredibly encouraging and insightful and wonderful to get to meet you in this particular way. Of course, I've heard you on the podcast, the Bible for Normal People podcast, but to see an articulated philosophy really laid out there was just really wonderful. I forgot to mention two things. I'm still suffering from a cough, so please forgive me, everybody, if I have to cough in the middle of this. I've got my water and my cough drops. And second, right below is the Slido event number 1190679. So towards the end of our conversation, we'll take some questions live from everybody who's watching. So please make sure that you populate that, and you can, of course, ask and upvote there. So let's just get started. What I'd like to do is start at 30,000 foot. What are you actually saying? What are you trying to communicate through your book? And then I want to dig in, and I want to warn you up front that some of my questions are going to be friendly fire. They're coming from somebody who profoundly loves what you've written, but I'm going to try to bring up some of the conservative / fundamental / critical rebuttals to some of your hypothesis, because I'd like to really flesh this out a little bit more. And I think I have just discerned that you're the kind of person that's up for it. And I didn't ask your permission beforehand, so if you're okay with that.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's just start with the 30,000 foot level, just the overall general hypothesis. What do you mean that love matters more?
Yeah, I want to be clear, because I think some of the pushback I got when the book came out was this black and white thinking that is the main thing I'm arguing against, that that we've pitted love and truth against each other, and that we sort of have to choose. And if you're more conservative, you choose truth over love. And if you're more progressive, you choose love over truth. And I just want to break that binary down and say that they actually are not antagonistic. They actually go quite nicely together, but there is a hierarchy when we look closely at our Bibles. And that is that love does matter more. That doesn't mean truth doesn't matter at all. And I think that's often what people hear when we say love matters more. But I'm just saying, what is the relationship between the two in our Christian tradition, and how do we get them to play nicely? And the way I came out after, you know, reading and doing my studies and writing the book is that love is what matters more. And within that, truth plays a vital role. But when it starts to usurp love is when it can get dangerous.
Right. Well, the hierarchy that you're pointing out, in some ways, plays the other direction as well. And I know that you're trying to synthesize the two, but in many ways, you're also trying to combat the reverse hierarchy, the other hierarchy that has existed. That if I had a conflict or situation or circumstance in which loving somebody was in conflict with me telling them the truth, then that hierarchy is, I have to tell them the truth, right?
Yeah, that's a great way. I mean, I focus on this phrase that I heard so much growing up, telling the truth or speaking the truth in love. Right. And I say, when we say speaking the truth in love, at least in the context I heard it, the emphasis always fell on the truth telling. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is that you tell the truth. Now, we have to caveat that and say you have to do it lovingly, but the most important thing is you tell the truth.
Right.
And so love is the adjective and truth telling is the noun. That's mm-hmm. like the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And what is it? If we had true love, rather than speaking the truth in love, what if we had true love, where true is the adjective, love is the verb or the noun in that case, where the emphasis falls on the love.
Right. Oh, how I want to throw in a clip from Princess Bride right now. True love. I'm sorry. My poor people at Spark know that I have to throw Princess Bride into virtually every message I give. So anyway, the idea that you're combating, again, let me just flesh out a little bit more and see what your thoughts are. The mechanism or the process by which we do both truth and love is kind of in a reverse direction. For example, I am loving you by telling you the truth, right? I smuggle in truth, or I know that sorry, I smuggle in love. I know that love is important, but I do that primarily through speaking the truth. And what you're saying is the opposite. You can, truth does matter, and you need to make sure truth gets there, but it gets there through the way of love. Is that another appropriate way of kind of fleshing out more details of what you're proposing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, and I think it's important that in the schema or the framework that you just laid out, we have to ask the question, which I think is important, but does truth-telling result always in love? Because that's the premise. I love you by telling you the truth. And so we have to dissect that and ask, okay, does telling someone the truth always mean it's love? What are the circumstances when it's not love? And how do we discern between those? Because I think, yes, we do a lot of damage by smuggling in this idea of love in the guise of truth telling, when usually what's smuggled in isn't necessarily love. It's usually defensiveness or ego or harm or abuse or defending systems of thought. And we have to be able to distinguish that from love.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into that definition of love, because you're you're promoting and proposing essentially a pretty contrary definition of love. Love is telling somebody the truth. And here you seem to be proposing that love, and I think you even say it in your book, love has to be evaluated based upon how somebody else feels. Can you make a defense for that kind of what I will call the big words? Epistemological phenomenology. You're basically proposing that the validity of the truth that you tell and the love that is that you're showing somebody is contingent upon if somebody actually feels that they are being loved. Is that, am I reading you correctly, or do you want to clarify, or how would you defend that or support that, I suppose?
I think of love as a relational term. And I think that's an important way to think about this, is what do we mean by loving someone? The definition for me is relational. And in love, we can't define it only about the person doing the loving. We also have to define it by the person being loved. And I think because I define love in a relational term, as a relational term, both sides of the coin matter. Another way of saying it, and this comes from, you know, the world of psychology or therapy, that when we're talking about love, we have two parts that matter, both intention and impact. So it's not one or the other. It can't just be my loving intention. If my loving intention causes harm, we don't call that love. If the impact is loving, but my intention is for harm, we don't call that love. And so it's this intersection, or what I would say is a relationality, this intersection of impact and intention.
Okay, so let's ask a little bit of a deeper question. Why do you think Christianity has, or certain segments of Christianity, I should say, to be clearer, become that? What are the historical or theological or various philosophical ways in which that has become the predominant mode? Because what you're proposing essentially is that the thesis that you're advancing is essentially what Jesus was trying to drive forward, and yet the Christian church has done the complete opposite. So what are, in your view, have been the ways in which that has come about?
I mean, how much time do we have to go through kind of the history of the Christian church? But I think
38
you know,
we have
some flashpoints. One of those, you know, in the Reformation, we're tying Christianity during the Reformation to what we call like pre-Enlightenment or the beginnings of an Enlightenment thinking. And in that, we're trying to really get certain about things. And traditionally, how we got certain was through the authority of the church. If the Pope or the institution of the church said something was true and right, it was true and right by nature of their authority. It was God ordained, and God told the church the right things, and then the church told the people. And so during this time of the Reformation, we, you know, had this rallying cry of the Renaissance called Ad Fontes, back to the sources. Like, we're not going to trust the authority of this anymore. We need to figure it out for ourselves. And that's the rise of reason. Hmm. So us thinking critically for ourselves becomes the main mode by which we gain truth. Hmm. Before that, we didn't gain truth by thinking for ourselves and building logical arguments. We gained truth by obeying the authorities. On the civic side, that was the king or the magistrates who had been ordained by God. So they got their truth directly from God, and then they implemented it through politics. And then you had the church, the pope, or the bishops who got it directly from God, and then they instituted it on the religious side. And so those were the two places where we got truth. And then we'd call that mediated, right? It comes through an institution. Well, then around the time of the Reformation, you have folks like Martin Luther or others who are starting to say, Ad Fontes, let's go back to the sources. Let's figure it out for ourselves. The problem is, if we all figure it out for ourselves, how does that keep us? Why are we will devolve into wars and riots, right? During the time of Martin Luther, there's this, the peasants' revolt. And it's sort of like, oh, wait, I've just opened Pandora's box, where if we all just get to designate it for ourselves. And so we have to figure out how we're going to do this together. And we figure out that we reason together. Yeah. We come back to laws of logic, A plus B equals C. Okay, and so we start building systems of thought this way, all the way, you know, we get to the famous René Descartes, who says, I think, therefore I am. And that's like his foundation for certainty. And he builds an entire framework of thought on top of that. And then thinkers after him start saying, oh, we like what he did, but his foundation was wrong. It's this foundation. And that's what we call foundationalism. Hmm. The idea that we can get to the undoubtable foundation of certainty. And so we build science on this. We start gaining all kinds of knowledge and progress scientifically and medically through reason. But then at some point we start to deify reason, kind of, reason becomes our God. Hmm. Everything has to have a reason. And Christianity starts to actually acquiesce to this and starts to agree everything has to have a reason, right? And so we get, you know, fast forward all the way to the 20th century. Apologetics is essentially making Christianity reasonable. That's what we're trying to do. Because reason has become the God, everything has to be reasonable. It has to make sense universally to all of us. And so apologetics is trying to make sure Christianity feels reasonable to everyone.
Yeah.
And so we're swimming in the water. If we're in the West in the 21st century, we are swimming in 500 years of the legitimate way to truth and knowledge is through reason. It's through logic and through scientific discovery. And we've emphasized that, in my opinion, we've overemphasized to the detriment of relationship and love. We have overemphasized capital T truth, which you could equal as capital R reason.
Mm-hmm. That's actually connected to one of the things that you come out of the gate on in your book. You say that the idea of only of experiencing speaking the truth in love and being received as only pain and loneliness is abuse. And mm-hmm. you call it spiritual abuse, which is a really loaded term. Of course, there's a lot of necessary nuances and intricacies that's for a different podcast. What I'm interested in what you just said, and for this particular conversation, is that, and I know you know this because you've studied a lot of this, abuse can sometimes be considered or that sense or feeling can sometimes be considered an adaptation in many ways. Hey, stop it, my dogs. Some sort of adaptation to, you know, some tragedy or difficulty or challenge in things. And the very reason and rationality that you mentioned during that period of time also emerged into like a anti-Bible, the things that you believe are not true. Oh, Noah's Ark is just a myth and all these kinds of things. And it feels like Christianity also attempted to defend itself against those kinds of ideas as well. I'd be kind of curious if that also resonates with your kind of hypothesis that the very same thing that caused the Christian church to glob on to reason and rationality as its primary mode of operation was also the very thing that kind of advanced the defensive posture, because mm-hmm. Christianity felt like it was being attacked on that particular way, thus leading to a kind and brand of Christianity that now needs to pound that apologetic truth into people.
Yeah, absolutely. To go back to what you said, I kind of fast forwarded through all of that to get to kind of the apologetics where we're defending Christianity. Mostly what apologetics is defending against within Christianity is attacks on, some of the claims of a certain Christian tradition, right? And what I'm thinking of, particularly this comes to a head in the early 20th century in America in the modernist debates around evolution, around scientific discovery, and around biblical criticism, right? So science and logic is all fine and good as long as it's in lockstep with what we've always believed about the Christian tradition. Well, in the 1800s and 1900s, science starts to turn its eye toward Christianity and saying, well, if we use this same logical framework or scientific method on claims within, say, Christianity, again, Western Christianity in the 20th century and 19th century, we start to see that it maybe doesn't hold up. And so now they're pitted against each other, right? So classically, six-day creation, evolution, right? And so that's when, if you hear the term fundamentalist, that term of the fundamentals comes in the early 20th century, where certain Christians felt like we had to double down and say, well, we need to double down on the fundamentals. And if you think about that term, based on what we talked about earlier, it sounds a lot like foundationalism, right? Mm. It's the foundation, the fundamentals, the thing that cannot be doubted, the certainty of our faith rests upon these five things, right? And one of those ended up being formulated over the years, what we call inerrancy, the inerrancy of Scripture, because we need to guard against anything that's going to challenge our certainty, the certainty that we are right, the certainty that we have the truth. And one of the ways we have to defend against that is to defend an inerrant Bible. And again, that then generates all this conflict and controversy in the 20th century around, science and faith, or again, progressive Christian traditions and more conservative Christian traditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's push this to the next level then, because you mentioned that as we are attempting to defend Christianity and the faith against these attacks, we're also trying to apologetically define that we can actually know. But you are proposing an epistemological posture that suggests we actually can't ever really know. I mean, you say, page 13, we are not able to grasp absolute truth or reality as it really is, suggesting, page 65 later, absolute truth has become one of the church's golden calves. That, I can imagine, is not received very well. So tell me a little bit more about that. Tell me how it's been received.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is probably one of the fundamental things that I want to say in the book. And that is, we have made absolute truth into God. That's what we're really trying to defend. We're trying to defend our sense of certainty that rests on us having a grasp the absolute truth of things, that we see reality as it really is. And I think there are, as you've used the word, epistemological problems with that. I think it doesn't purport with what we know about how people come to know things. But I also think there's a moral problem with that, because I think it leads to inevitable violence and defensiveness and harm. Hmm. And so we have to deal with both sides of that. I think that those are both wrongheaded. And I think the challenge for me is that we have wedded them so closely together that when people hear me say, we don't have access to absolute truth, what they hear is, I am attacking Christianity. Mm-hmm. And I think that very confusion is what I find problematic, that you are connecting those so strongly that for me to even question one is to question the other.
Yeah, that's really good. Would you consider that theologically idolatry?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you have no problem equating Baal and Molech and all these ancient gods. I mean, what they were doing then is what we're essentially doing now. We've just shifted from a piece of stone to an idea.
Well, I would even go further than that, because one of the points I make is, you know, one of the aha moments I have in seminary is reading closely Exodus chapter 32 in the original Hebrew. You do that, you go real slow, right? And you pick up on things. And what I realized in that episode of the golden calves is that when Aaron holds up a golden calf, he doesn't say, "Behold, this is your God," and leave it there. It is not the same as a Molech. It is not the same as a stone. He actually says, Aaron says, "Behold, Yahweh, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Mm. He's equating this with God, mm-hmm. not another God. He's saying, no, this is the form, which is what idol means, right? It comes from eidos in Greek, means form. This is the shape that God takes. It's not some other God. It's not some foreign God. And I think that's the thing with idolatry that's so sneaky, is it's easy to identify when it's another God. But what happens whenever we say, no, that's Yahweh, that's our God, and we conflate the two? And I think that's what we've done with certainty and with absolute truth. We haven't said that's another God. We've said that's what Yahweh is.
That's quite an incredible statement. And I can imagine what you just said is the fundamental reason why people like yourself and the Bible for Normal People and Pete Enns and other people get into trouble. Because you are attacking the idol. And the idol is the thing that we worship. And the idol is the thing that gives us certainty and clarity and identity of who we are. And if you're saying that that's not true, valid, or whatever, you're attacking me, buddy. So... okay, so let's shift this from kind of a posture about, and you do a wonderful job in the book identifying fact, truth, meaning, truth, and wisdom, truth. So let's put that in the category of we have made an idol out of absolute truth. Does this include morality? Because one of the pieces that gets conflated in Christianity is the reason why we can have certainty about the theology of God. And in fact, I'm sure you're very well aware that, that one of the primary arguments out there is if we say that Genesis is false, then the rest of the Bible is false. And that just leads us down to moral relativism and subjectivism. So if we're going to say that we don't really know or we can't really have access to an absolute truth and we're making an idol out of that, how does that apply to morality? And what are you proposing is kind of our moral epistemology or our moral sense and identity?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I want to go back to say, I don't want to ever minimize people's fears. Mm. So like you said earlier about abuse as a way to cope, I think a lot of these are ways to cope with a world that feels scary and uncertain. And that's a very real thing. And so I don't at all... fault people for that. And I spent most of my life with that. And so I just want to make sure, like, we have to validate people's fears. They're very real concerns. And I get it. But within morality, we run into a problem. And that is if we look that over time, our morality around things has in fact changed. So what I don't know necessarily what we mean by absolute truth when it comes to morals. Usually when somebody tries to defend it, they will say things like, well, it's just common sense. Mm-hmm. Or we all know, you know, in your heart of hearts. And so whenever you are dismissing it, it's because you just want to go sin, right? So it has to be, we have to describe it some evil intention. Mm. When I just look at, you know, I grew up in a tradition where watching rated R movies was sinful and worthy of feeling guilty and needing to confess and, you know, listening to certain types of music and dancing. And when I look in the history of Christian tradition, we can pick out almost anything that we do today And at some point, it was considered immoral, right? And looking even at evangelicals in the last 30 years on the topic of gay marriage, if you look at evangelicals 30 and under, the amount that are approving of same-sex marriage, it's over half. So what do we mean by then this absolute moral code?
Well, you're obviously bringing up one of the most contentious of the topics and issues. I don't know if you've been following anything online of a most recent conference that happened down in Georgia or not, but this has become a pretty significant topic because the commentators are out in full force with this exact very argument. And if I can understand, do my best to try to discern what it is that they're saying, is that this moral shift, specifically on gay marriage in the church, does not change the fact that the Bible is clear regarding what marriage is. Sorry, Jared, I'm going to put you on record here because there is a... So the church can have all sorts of different opinions throughout history, but it doesn't change the fact that there is absolute moral clarity on this. So how does your approach, philosophy, framework have a conversation with somebody like that?
Again, I think it's important to think about the whole worldview or whole framework rather than a particular idea. Because the idea that there are things that are very clear, I would first want to understand more about that. And that's always my approach. I'm not actually a very combative person. I subscribe to the curiosity over judgment kind of at all costs.
Because you're in the right place.
I often say curiosity and judgment make poor roommates. You usually can't have one with the other in the same room. So I want to be curious. I want to understand what that means. And again, I don't want to be at all condescending, but if we go down a couple of steps, that in my mind, that starts to break down. What do you mean it's clear in the Bible what marriage is? There are plenty of examples where marriage is having multiple wives. There are plenty of examples where marriage is being able to take concubines if you're a person of power. So I don't know what that means. I also come from a tradition who would say it's very clear what the Bible has to say about homosexuality or gay marriage. And I remember very distinctly 20 years ago, they were very clear about what the Bible says about divorce. Mm-hmm. And they were very clear about what the Bible says about women in leadership. And those are starting to topple like dominoes as well. Mm-hmm. And so in my experience with church history, things that were once very clear quickly become not as clear, which then quickly become acceptable. And so I just don't think it's helpful to talk about things in the Bible in terms of morality being very clear. Yeah. Because the Bible is kind of murky.
Well, and let's be clear about why and how you hold this posture, because there's a whole segment of Christianity of which many of us are a part of that would say that embracing the dynamics of our moral evolution and the change and realization is actually not unfaithfulness. It's actually a deep, profound commitment to a biblical narrative, to the way of Jesus. Is that so? Let's make that clear and give you give our audience a sense that the attack or the kind of demeaning of that kind of posture is to say, look, you guys are abandoning true, faithful, biblical, historical Christianity. And I would propose that you are saying we're actually doing the opposite. We're actually embracing even stronger and more faithfully the way of Jesus as found in our biblical tradition.
Yeah, and it gets very nuanced. And so I do understand that if you come from a tradition who sees the Bible in a certain way, I think it's going to be very difficult to change that entire framework around what the Bible is. Right? So if you have always read the Bible through the lens of an absolute, a guidebook to absolute truth, it's going to be very hard to see the Bible as something that evolves and develops over time. Yeah. But again, if you take time to sort of read the scholarship and trust the scholarship, which again, I know is hard to do because I grew up being taught I can't trust the scholarship and can't trust critical thinking around the Bible. I think you'll find exactly that. I mean, to kind of fast forward through a lot of it, at the very least, we have to grapple with Jesus being able to say, you know, you've heard it said this, but I say that. You've heard it said one thing, but I'm here to tell you something else, right? And again, we have this development where we can find things in our New Testament or even within the later parts of the Hebrew Bible that would contradict what it says in the Older Testament. For instance, the idea of does sin pass from one generation to the next? In earlier Hebrew Bible traditions, it says yes, up into the seventh generation. And by the time we get more to later periods of the Hebrew Bible, it says, no, that doesn't make any sense. That one generation would be accounting for the sins of a previous generation. That seems unjust and unfair. And so here we have the dialogue, we have the tension within the Hebrew Bible itself. And we find that again and again, not just with the moral imperatives, but with the narratives themselves.
Okay, so let's get to some of the things that you're proposing. I think we spent some time talking about the things that seem to be missing the mark, sinful, shall we call, of the church, missing the mark. Let's get to the things that you're actually proposing. You write on page 77, the call of Christianity is to imitate Jesus, not to try to understand Christianity. Explain. Because that sounds like a contradiction. Isn't Christianity founded upon its founder, Jared?
Yeah, and I don't want to pit Christianity against Jesus in this. That, in the broader context of what I'm trying to say in that section, I'm introducing the thinker Soren Kierkegaard, who is trying to say, he has this famous quote where he says, Christianity entered into the world not to be understood, but to be existed in. And I think sometimes, and I'm guilty of this, and I'm writing this book for myself, that I can think that what the Christian life is about is thinking right thoughts. Overall, that's for me, the water we swim in, the thing that I think we have privileged to our own detriment, is that belief, mental assent, without any embodiment, that as long as I am thinking the correct thoughts, I am being a faithful follower of Jesus. And I don't see that anywhere in our Bible. I don't see that thinking true thoughts is what brings a life and brings it to the full, right? It brings a life of following Jesus. There is an embodiment element. When we read the letters of John, 1st, 2nd John, 3rd John, I delight in this, knowing that my disciples are walking in the truth. Walking in the truth. Walking is a verb. It is an embodied term. It is not just a disembodied thought bubble that we can sit behind a keyboard and type out on social media.
Yeah. I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle that seems to be so missing, and it kind of betrays the very thing that you're pointing out, is that we're living in such a dichotomized view that if you say X, then you must be saying anti-Y. And I appreciate how you're trying to say, but no, it's okay. Because one of my questions here was, how can you suggest that Jesus is more important than Christianity, or that way is a better reading of the Bible, when I get my entire understanding of Jesus from Christianity, from the Bible, right? So it feels like this dichotomy. And I appreciate how you're trying to hold all of those together. You use the analogy of the Bible as a pile of compost. And I think you brought that from somebody else who might have given that metaphor. So explain to us, what do you mean? Because that seems like a very not nice thing to say.
I mean, I just mean that the Bible's garbage. What's wrong with that?
Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. I mean, that's all. I'm going to put that. That's going to be the next Instagram meme right there. The Bible is a bunch of garbage. Jared Bias, Bible for normal people.
Exactly. Thank you. I would appreciate it if you did that. No, I get it from Walter Brueggemann, which, again, if you look at the warp and woof of Walter Brueggemann's life, someone dedicated to the church, a preeminent biblical scholar, who says we should maybe think of the Bible as a pile of compost. And by that, he's getting at this idea that the Bible is rich, but it's not rich because it's alive in some abstract sense, but because out of it, life grows, right? It is a rich deposit of, the biblical witness is a rich deposit out of which our life can grow. The point is that it is the engine that we use then to manifest a life of faithfulness. That's what the purpose of it is. It is not to just get fat, right? Or as Paul says, not to puff up as knowledge can do, right? Knowledge puffs up. And so that's what we have kind of turned the Bible into, is my quiet time, my devotion, Bible studies. In the Christian tradition I grew up in, I was given preeminent place. I was given leadership positions. I was put in front of everyone. Was it because I loved people well? No. It was because I knew more than everyone. And everyone said, ooh, ah, look at him. He's so spiritual. Why was I spiritual? Because I knew more than people. I had memorized a lot of scriptures. And yet the people who were not put in front were often the people who were serving, who were loving, who were sacrificing, who were actually doing the things that the Bible has told us to do. They were being relegated to the back. I was ushered to the front. And that privilege shows me that we have gotten these things out of whack.
So let's talk about what will put it back in whack, if that's even a phrase that we can use. You articulate three kinds of truth: fact truth, meaning truth, and wisdom truth. And I like this fun little quote: knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit, but wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad. So let's talk about what kind of truth then are you advocating for that you see profoundly grounded in our biblical narrative in the way of Jesus? What is that wisdom truth that you are suggesting we prioritize?
Yeah, I mean, it for me, this is where it's going to get a little bit tricky, but the wisdom truth, the highest order of wisdom is to love, right? Jesus says it in the greatest commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Paul reiterates it again and again, but the greatest of these is love, right? So being able to love well is a form of truth. And I think the reason that sometimes short circuits our brain is because we've been taught to think that truth is abstract. It is just an assent to fact. But love is fact embodied for the good of others, for the good of ourselves, right? It's not fact that just sits, but it's fact that works. And when you get facts to work, you realize really quickly that the world is more nuanced and way less black and white than it says it in a textbook. And that's wisdom, is working out the facts and the meaning of our faith tradition, of our relationships, of how we were built, of all the things we learned in school, working it out in real life with the intent to love others well builds a life of wisdom.
Let's apply this to, and this will be, I think, my last question, because we got several questions that have come through that I want to make sure that I honor from the audience. Can we apply this to the entire thing, to perhaps the most important element, and I'll take away the perhaps, the most important element of the Christian faith and tradition, which is the resurrection? Because you say this on page 79, the better question, other than is the resurrection true, the better question is, do we trust in Jesus's resurrection? That is going to be, a real, like, apply this to this particular idea in theology, because Paul is making an argument that if the material historical fact of the resurrection isn't true, then your faith is in vain. And it does feel to some a slippery slope to relativism, or even a completely revisionist version of Christianity, to say, well, it doesn't actually matter if the resurrection happened or not. What matters is this thing. Do you trust it? Do you believe in it? So apply this entire thing to this being the most important element of the claims of Christianity, the resurrection.
I mean, I can only take it in the two steps that I take it. One is, none of us know for sure if the resurrection happened. How would you know? I don't know how we would know. Mm. So I don't know. So to go back with Paul and say, if it didn't happen, our faith is in vain. Mm. That may very well be true. If it didn't happen, our faith is in vain. What do we do with the reality that I don't know if it's true or not? What I have to do is have faith. What I have to do, which is my second point, I have to live as though it's true. Not know that it's true, but to live as though it's true. Mm. And that's what I mean. Not that it doesn't matter. It's that I can't know, and yet I still have to live a life of resurrection faith. Mm. That's the courageous thing. And yet I think what we're searching for is a sense of certainty. We have to know that we know that we know, which is what my grandma used to say every time we saw her. If you died tonight, would you know that you know that you know that you're going to heaven? Mm-hmm. And the answer I have to give is no. Mm. I don't know that I know that I know. I have something far scarier, but perhaps far more valuable, which is trust. Mm. And so for me, would it be great if we could know for certain? Sure, I would love that. I just don't think that's the world we live in. Mm. Even Paul says we know only in part. Paul, who knew way more than I did, who lived way closer to all of this than I did, says, we don't know. We know only in part. We see through a glass dimly. Only then, later, will we see in full. Hmm. And so I'm no better than Paul. I can only see in part. And yet I am still called to live a life of resurrected faith.
Yeah. Wow, Jared. It's going to give us something to chew on for a little while. I'm reminded of a quote that we've batted around a little while, that the opposite of doubt is not faith, but the opposite of doubt is certainty. And I really appreciate the honesty in that response, given all of the works. I mean, I know N.T. Wright's big 700-page volume, Mike Lacona's 700-page volume, you know, on the historical validity of the resurrection. So it's going to be, I think, a wonderful response to wrestle with. So I was a part of a wonderful book club over the last several weeks going over your book. And so here are some questions that came from that. Let's just start with this one. Have you heard from people from a more fundamentalist background respond to your book?
Yeah. It's been interesting because I think most of like the one-star reviews on like Amazon and Goodreads were, he has some really good thoughts, but they couldn't get past the idea that perhaps we need to include LGBTQ people into our congregations and into our faith. Mm. That's been the primary fundamentalist response, which for me is very telling, that they get to a certain point and they can't get beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of our people asked, is there any room for tough love in your framework? And kind of the example was somebody who might be facing an addiction or a challenge, and there's an intervention, and you need to tell somebody, you know, the hard truth as part of their process of loving them through their addiction and their journey. So what would you say about tough love?
Yeah, I think there is, but I think there's so much more conversation that needs to happen around that. Mm. One of the things that I think, and I point this out in the book, one thing I don't like is when we jump to tough love and we use kids as an example.
Oh, mm.
Because I am responsible for my kids who are not able to make decisions for themselves in some capacity. And I am responsible to help them do that. But that is very different than adults. Mm-hmm. In relationship with other adults. I have to learn to respect other people's autonomy. Mm. And so intervention, absolutely. So I mean, if you kind of see me in my personal life, I'm a very direct person and I'll tell people what I think a lot. But I also will respect if they disagree with me. I will not cut off relationship. I won't make it awkward. I won't make them feel condescended to. Mm-hmm. Won't belittle them. I trust them. I respect their own decisions for their own life. Yeah. And so that's where I feel like that comes into play is, yeah, absolutely there is, but I feel like there's so much more nuance that people take advantage of in that.
I so appreciate that. Ted Med Ted McCat. Geez, I feel so nourished by this discussion, which made me think of this other question that emerged in our book club. What launched you into this way of thinking? And part of the question around that is to ask the question, what causes somebody to, I suppose, go from the background that you had to thinking in this particular way? Because it feels like, in many ways, are there ways or things that we can be doing to help other people kind of come to this level of view or enlightenment or perspective?
My honest answer is I hurt a lot of people along the way.
Oh, wow.
And I became aware of the hurt I was causing. So I think for me, if I flip that story into any kind of lesson, it's how can we help people see the impact that they're having on other human beings? Because that's what did it for me, is I started to recognize all my arguing wasn't bringing about any healing or love or goodness. It was bringing strife and harm and hurt feelings and hurt relationships. And that wasn't the kind of person I wanted to be.
Oh, wow. I want to just sit with that for a while. That level of empathic humanity is the thing that seems to be so truncated when we prioritize an abstract conceptual structure of belief, right? We lose that element of our humanity. And the fact that, gosh, your answer is just so, it's just so cutting. What caused me to change? I hurt people. That's incredibly powerful. And I appreciate you so much sharing. From the Slido question, I want to gift this book to everyone I know. I'm sure you're very happy to hear that, but that might be too much too soon. Do you have recs for what books to give loved ones to ready them for this book?
You know what? I don't know it off the top of my head, but I do know, there was a review I read somewhere where they basically, there was one that said, this is very similar to this book. You should check it out. And another one who referred them to the same book and basically said, basically ditch Jared's book. This one's better. And by that, they meant it's just more conservative, but gives the same points.
Oh, interesting.
So that one might be a better one, but it's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer, but what it will cause me to do is find that. And maybe Kevin, I can send it to you once I find it.
Okay, no problem. The next question that came in, we agree that no one can credibly claim to possess absolute truth, or hopefully many of us agree to that. Can we credibly claim to possess love? If so, what that might asymmetry teach us?
No, again, for me, I don't know if we can possess love. I think we show love in the same way that I think we show truth. I'm a very process-oriented person. And so I think of it in terms of relationship, right? And so truth is a relational term. Love is a relational term. Mm. So I don't think we possess it, we pursue it. Mm. For me, I'm always pursuing truth, rarely possessing it, always pursuing love, rarely possessing it. Mm. I wouldn't even know it if I had it.
Yeah.
What I do know is both are worth pursuing.
Yeah, I love that. That's so fantastic. another question that came in, I would appreciate hearing how your hypothesis applies today in dealing with conservative Christians who might hold beliefs such as white Christian nationalism.
I get this a lot. I mean, I think this is where the challenge is. What I want to make sure I'm very clear about is I'm not advocating doormat theology. Right? Doormat theology says we just have to love everyone and just let them hurt us, hurt our loved ones. And that's what being like Jesus means, is being a doormat for other people. And so we have to recognize that love can sometimes confront and sometimes needs to confront. And it kind of goes back to that tough love idea. Mm-hmm. I do think that the details of that matter. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very personal question to ask, why am I confronting this person? Mm. Where does my anger come from? Where does my sense of justice come from? How might my ego be wrapped up in all of this? How might my own trauma be wrapped up in all of this? How do I heal from my trauma in a way that would help me to address these things in a healthier way? I think all of those are important questions. What I want to make sure and say is, I think these injustices in our world need confronting. Hmm. I just don't know if there's a level of self-awareness sometimes to recognize my motives for that.
Oh, man, that takes a lot.
That's what you have to be
takes a lot of introspection. In many ways, I mean, this is the hard part. The very things that you're talking about that have led you down this particular path that I know many in my community have also participated in, that level of introspection, like to know that you've hurt people, that level of empathy, that level of awareness is not something that you can necessarily, you know, teach people. Some of that just has to be innate to somebody's own emotional development. Mm-hmm. Which, as I'm saying that out loud, seems to be incredibly apropos, because our ability to have that kind of empathy, that sense of connection with another person, that sense of sensitivity to how other people are emotionally navigating the world, comes as a result of us being actually very well loved. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly important and cyclical and necessary to get that foundation and grounding. So I need to explain this question that was posted in the Slido. In our book club, one truth we discussed in addition to the to the three that you defined, Jared, was fidelity, which I suggested. What is your take on that fourth truth? And that fourth truth, I mentioned to my book club that in, for example, Jonah is the son of Amittai, and the Hebrew word emet there means truth, but it is connected etymologically to the word faithfulness, emunah. And so I shared with them that there seems to be another truth that Jared is implicitly discussing, which is truth, which is fidelity to the claim that I am making. If I'm saying that I'm a follower of Jesus, then the life that I'm living in with integrity and fidelity is also true. That is what it means to be true to oneself and that kind of thing. So I think this person is asking for your take on it. And I might have summarized portions of your book that I did not quote very well, so you can help clarify that as well.
Yeah, I was trying to find, because you say implicitly, but I would actually say what you're talking about in terms of fidelity or faithfulness is the primary meaning of truth in the Hebrew Bible. Emet is a term of faithfulness or trueness to another person. It's an honesty. It's to be in honest relationship. It's to not deceive one another. And that's, I say that with the point I make in the book, which maybe I don't draw out the fidelity part quite enough, is that it's an ethical term. Mm-hmm. Right? It's opposed to wickedness. The opposite of wickedness is trueness. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't expect that. Usually the opposite of truth is false. But in the Hebrew Bible, it's so relational and ethical that the opposite of truth is wickedness. And that truth there doesn't mean an abstract idea. It doesn't mean facts or meaning or necessarily wisdom. It is a faithfulness, mm-hmm, to the other person such that I am being honest with them.
Yeah. It wasn't listed in your three, but it is clear. Page 85 and 86, from truth and love to true love. And that's why in my notes, that's where I put the Princess Bride clip. But the Bible asks us to walk in truth, which is defined as faithfulness, trustworthiness, honesty and fair testimony, authenticity, commitment to doing good. If we map these uses of truth in the Bible onto the love ingredients, commitment as faithfulness, trust as trustworthiness, honesty as honesty and fair testimony, openness as authenticity, care, affection, and recognition as commitment to doing good. And then on page 86, you write, in the Bible, truth is an ethical category, not an intellectual one. It's a relational category, not an individual one.
Yeah. So I think biblically, I think, you know, Kevin, absolutely. I think that idea of fidelity is overwhelmingly present. For the purposes of that fact, meaning, and wisdom, I start the book by just saying this is how we normally use the word true. Mm-hmm. We kind of conflate all three of these things. I don't think we really use the word true to mean faithfulness anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Except when we're like reading Shakespeare, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's why your work and your voice is just so critically important. Jared, we're out of time, and I want to respect your time because you're out there on the East Coast. I'm so, so, so grateful. Our book club was really wonderful. Our people so much appreciated your articulation of this idea and this way of Jesus and the biblical fidelity that this kind of approach has. I'm going to put you on a spot because I know you've been a pastor. So at the very close, I would love for you to exhort those who are watching with some sort of encouragement or exhortation towards this posture, towards this idea. Maybe somebody's still wrestling, but I don't, this is very scary. I don't know what it means to wade into a place where, you know, I can't know absolute truth, and love seems to be more complicated, and it's, you know, relational and messy. What would you challenge us or inspire us or encourage us as we come to a close regarding love mattering more?
Yeah. I would maybe say this, you know, may you go forward trusting the voice inside you that compels you to love. I've heard over and over that the instinct was to love and to include and to welcome and to comfort. And it was teachings from the outside that questioned it, that caused them to say, maybe I'm too soft, or maybe I don't understand. And I think I've learned the most from the people who didn't understand all the complexities of truth and theology, but stood under their own intuition that love matters more. And that as messy as it was, they were going to keep trying, they were going to keep showing up, and they were going to keep being in the mix. So I would say, trust that voice inside that's compelling you to love.
The very definition of having faith, to trust. I love it. Friends, thank you all for joining us. The book, Love Matters More. Jared, in all seriousness, this is a brilliant and beautiful gift. It is challenging because of the cultural milieu in which we're all living, the history of Christianity, the kind of cultural fights that we're all in. But if more people would glob on to consider, even maybe just test out exactly what you've written here, which is really, should I say, you got this from Jesus. This wasn't original, right? but if more people would do this, that would radically change everything. That would change Christianity. That would change the kind of impact that Christianity and the church has upon the world. And it is so much in line with the way of Jesus, the agenda that he was attempting to advance in this world, and people like yourself who are working hard to reclaim it and to push it forward are people that we love and appreciate to the nth degree. So thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for sharing. We appreciate it so much.
Thanks for hosting, Kevin. You're so gracious. I really appreciate it.